You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to my podcast, You Can't Say That. And it is May 12th, and we are almost 3 months into the COVID-19 lockdown. And before lockdown, I had banked over half a year of podcast and was going to take a lot of time off. But then I thought the world as we know it has changed. And I wanted to check in with artists about how they're surviving and what they see for the future. So my next guest is a playwright, an actor, a producer, a director, a television writer. And we met in New York when I went to a programming for an organization he founded called the New Black Fest. And the New Black Fest is described on its website as a theater festival, a movement, a call to action inspired by the state of Black theater in the 21st century. Please welcome Keith Joseph Atkins. Hey, Keith, how you doing?
Good, good. How are you? So glad to be here. Thank you for the invite.
Oh, absolutely. So I have a million questions for you.
Yes, of course.
You're in LA, right?
Yes, like currently, yes.
So what's the state of life there right now?
Well, for the most part, so I was working on a television show.
P-Valley, which my guest, I had Katori Hall on here.
Oh, you did? Oh, yeah. So I'm not on P-Valley anymore. I was on another show called The Witches of New York, which is a new Netflix show that's sort of in progress, basically. But when the sort of shutdown happened, or the shutdown order or stay-at-home order happened, we were still in the room, and then we obviously were told we were not coming back to the room until we were doing the last couple of writing rooms virtually. And so I think at that point, everyone was just sort of still looking over their shoulder, like, what's really going on? Like, what does this mean? You know, and so people were sort of still kind of casual and still very, very hopeful about it resolving itself within a couple of weeks, or at least within a month. And obviously, you know, that didn't happen quite the way people wanted it to happen. And so currently, you know, I'm at home pretty much locked in except to go to the grocery store. Even though the governor of California has lifted the stay-at-home order, you know, people are definitely out more. But I'm not, because I'm one of those people who's kind of like, well, I hear what you're saying, but I just still want to protect myself and sort of read between the lines and make sure that it is safe. So I'm good, but I do notice that sort of collectively the Los Angeles community are out and about as if the storm is over.
Yeah.
Even like, I think a week or so, even before the stay-at-home order was lifted, I mean, I saw lots of people with maskless, not practicing social distancing. So it's a weird kind of like, you know, and you lived here, Tanya, so you understand, like, California has a sort of laid-back manana kind of attitude about a lot of things. And so right. People feel a little invincible because it's the weather's nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a, you know, a replacement for health. So it's like, yeah. Yo, just because it's sunny don't mean you're safe.
So. That's when I go walking over by the Hudson River here in New York, people are walking without masks, and it's like they think that the river is somehow protecting them from the virus or something.
Man, that's crazy. So crazy. Yeah. So no, it's very interesting. There's certainly a level of invincibility out here, at least, and obviously nationally. I just think there's just a built-in American invincibility that comes from perceiving ourselves as first world and therefore invincible and entitled and privileged, despite what the rest of the world is navigating, you know?
And it's interesting that idea of ourself is still holding strong, even though we are the COVID-19 epicenter of the world with 3 to 4 times more cases and deaths than any place in the world. We're number one in death and disease.
Right, exactly. Exactly. It's very interesting because like the invincibility quotient, if you want to call it that, definitely, you know, has two sides to it, obviously, right? Sort of the American, you know, we're invincible, so we can do anything and we can sort of, you know, cut down the trees and build a settlement, you know, despite who it hurts or whatever. And then the flip side of that is obviously in situations like this, like, yo, invincibility is not really a variable in this situation. It's like invincibility means like keeping your butt in the house and distancing when you're out, you know? So it's very curious and interesting, you know?
I was just emailing with someone in Israel today who has 5-year-old twins, and Israel is opening up kindergarten this week. And I told her, tell me more. Tell me more. How is that happening? We right. don't yet have a neutralizing antibody. I was speaking with the head of Quest Laboratories, and he said, maybe by Q3, Q4, we'll have a neutralizing antibody.
Mm.
And then we need to follow people with that for years to see how long it lasts. So.
Yeah. It's some real life happening on these streets, you know. And I was Zooming with a good friend of mine in North Carolina a few days ago, an actor friend of mine. And we were just talking about, like, you know, it's almost like an apocalyptic movie, you know, like the early sort of episodes of Walking Dead and or Fear Walking Dead, where everyone's sort of like, there's a virus, I believe, and people are being impacted by it, you know, and only a few people are really sort of taking it seriously, you know. And we were like talking about how perhaps in a year, he and I were going to be the few people who are going to still be Zooming while everybody's out and about. We're like, no, we're not going outside. We're still going to Zoom.
Well, you know, you and I both love the apocalyptic worlds.
Yeah. Yes.
I got to be on Fear of the Walking Dead.
I know.
Yeah.
I was so excited to see you. And, you know, I had a meeting with the creators of the show. I think it was right after when I was sort of the end of P-Valley, Katori's P-Valley for Star. So that was maybe a year and a half ago. And I think you had just, you know, did an arc on the show. And
right.
So talking to them about, I think your name came up in my meeting with them. And they were like, yeah, Ty. I was like, yes, oh my God. They were like, Ty is amazing. We can't wait for you to see the episode. I mean, you know, the episodes, plural, that she's going to be in. I was like, cool, yeah. So
I was looking at your television resume. We're going to get to your playwriting resume, but I want to look at your television resume because there's so many things on there, the jobs that you have. And I think a lot of times people don't understand. I mean, because I know a lot of television writers, I have a kind of understanding of the different jobs that people have in television writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of theater writers are going to be going to television or starting to figure out how to tell stories in remote ways. I saw that Lionsgate put out a list of suggestions that they only make shows with people who are already quarantined together.
Mm.
Did you see that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it says you've been a writer. You've been a staff writer. You've been a co-producer. You've been a story editor. Right. You've been an executive story editor. Can you give me a sense of what are those distinctions in job titles in television?
Well, those distinctions are simply about seniority, right? So it's all based on, so basically your first year in television on a television show, you are you're a writer no matter what title you have. You're writing or you're participating in the crafting of a story or a series whenever you're in that writer's room. So your first year, you're considered a staff writer. And then normally with that title, you're paid a staff writer salary weekly. You're often given two scripts to write. The first one you normally do not get paid for, but you do get the residuals for it. So that's like the first year staff writer. And then the second year on the show, you're a story editor. And then at that point, if you get scripts, you get paid for any scripts that you write, unlike the staff writer who doesn't get paid for the first script. And then the third year on a show, or your third year in writing in the industry, you're considered executive story editor. The fourth year, or the fourth show, if you want to call fourth show, fourth season, is considered co-producer. And then it goes to producer, and then it keeps going supervising, consulting, co-executive. So it all sort of depends on what year you're in, and you're in the year. So I actually had to start all over again. So back in the early aughts, I came out of grad school and got a job on Girlfriend, which was a CW show.
Yes.
Right. And so I was there as a staff writer because it was my first job ever. And then I came out of that show as an executive story editor. So then I took a long pause because I didn't think I was going to go back to television. I came back to New York to really sort of have my theater career because I didn't have it. I got kind of plucked away very quickly after grad school to television. So when I came back out here and got staffed on The Good Fight, which is a spinoff of The Good Wife for CBS All Access, I had to start all over as a staff writer. So it's like, so this is basically my seventh year collectively in television. I'm now at producer level, thankfully, on the new show, the new Witches of New York show.
But does it have it? Okay, I understand that as a writer, you don't get paid for the first script. But does each of these hierarchical name changes of seniority carry with them more money, more what? What's the meaning?
Yes. So each level or title from staff writer to producer, each has its own salary. So the salary increases each year. So if you have really great reps, hopefully the bump year to year is significant enough. But sometimes what happens in between the executive story editor and the producer, those three sort of titles, the salary increases just slightly. But once you get beyond producer, then it's bumped much more significantly.
And what's the bump to showrunner?
Well, showrunner, that's significant. So like if you get your own show, I don't know, I've read some places that showrunners make, I want to say like anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 a week. Per week. And more, obviously.
Right.
Yeah.
Just for the title.
Just for the title alone, and just for the title alone. And normally, well, I can't say that's not normal, but what you have two different type of executive producers. You have executive producers who have come through the ranks and sort of from staff writer all the way up to executive producer because of the number of years they've been working, right? And so that's one type of executive producer who have their salary based on just their seniority. And then mm-hmm. the other executive producer happens when you, say, example, go from a co-producer and then suddenly you have your own, you sold your own show and you're now an executive producer on your own show. So that salary is built around you being the creator of the show and then and the potential longevity of the show as well as your weekly salary. So that salary tends to be higher than the executive producer who's just sort of like, being pulled up through the ranks just on a linear line, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
Yeah.
So you came back to do theater and then you went back again. Tell me why?
It's a complicated story.
Of course. That's what I want to know.
Well, you know, I mean, Ty, you know, and you and I have had conversations about American theater, and you know, I love it. Again, like, I got plucked out of theater really quickly right out of grad school and was in television, and I felt like I never really had a chance to really experience theater professionally in New York City. So I wanted to come back after working on Girlfriend. After being in LA for 5 years, I came back to New York and I created the New Black Fest and continued and sort of started having a theater career. But then it became very clear to me, and I don't know if just out of my own maturity or my own sort of personal maturity or sort of creative maturity, that theater was a very limited space to tell story. And there was a lot of hands involved and a lot of filters involved as far as what's produced and what's even and who's commissioned or who's even read. Like, I'm one of the lucky people that I'm actually commissioned and read, and every so often I get a production, and that's like a rarity, an anomaly in theater, right? Mm-hmm. A production. And so when I kind of really kind of sat back and looked at that, I was like, playwriting has a very low ceiling of exposure. And so you're sitting at home, you know, wanting to tell all these stories, but you have to wait until somebody produces you. And that seems a little not interesting to me, because I'm an active person and I'm very proactive. So I started sort of calling myself a storyteller and just finding all possible ways to tell story and to continue to tell story, which sort of reopened my interest in television, because I realized that there was so much television happening at the time of this sort of epiphany for me that seemed much more inclusive and so much more expansive in the type of genre and points of views and the impact it was having on a much larger sort of international scale as far as exposing story. And so I thought, you know, maybe I should sort of go back into that realm, that sort of TV film sector space, even though it also has obviously its obstacles and it's, you know, it's Hollywood's so white and all those things are still very real. Like, most of the television rooms I get hired into, I'm the only person of color, and obviously the only black person, often the only male or definitely the only black male. And so, you know, it's definitely a challenge, but I do feel like there are many more advocates out in the industry now who are wanting diversity and inclusion and authority and truth, as opposed to theater that, you know, it's still very limited, you know? So that's why I decided to sort of stick my toe back into the TV world, TV film world.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
So in this moment in time where, you know, resources are funneling quickly to the top, and theater, for the moment, live theater is dead, and before I even sort of knew that this was going to last into next year, I began to wonder, did this mean that when things open up, you know, Black theaters, Latino theaters, Native American theaters, we always get the money last. When things open back up again, have you been thinking about, are we going to get it at all? Since there's going to be a very limited amount of resources, you know, are we going back to the end of the line again for them?
That's a very deep question. The history shows us, and the more recent history shows us, that funding usually is funneled to the larger institutions. And, you know, even I think, you know, like in the last 5 or 7 years, some of the smaller Black and people of color and other, you know, women's theaters and that are small have been, funds have been yanked from them and sort of funneled into, you know, these larger institutions, right? Even the larger institutions have found ways to sort of create spaces for so-called diversity and inclusion, which then makes the smaller companies that is their mission statement, not as, you know, attractive, because you can get all that at the larger institution. And so when you even think about, you know, what's happening now with this, you know, the businesses and the recovery package that the government is sort of, you know, handing out to folks. Like, you know, you hear about the small businesses who are suffering, some small businesses that have to close because they're not being able to survive. And so I imagine that the same thing is going to happen to theater. And it's already happening, you know, where smaller theater companies really have to figure out whether or not they're going to be able to survive the next month, you know. And yeah, so I think it's a very complicated, scary thing. And I was just talking to my managers yesterday about TV and film. They were saying that, you know, because, you know, what's really curious and interesting is that I'm continuing to have pitch meetings with production companies and producers, as well as conversations around developing projects, right? And I was saying to my manager yesterday, I was like, well, okay, so say, for example, my show is, I pitch something and it is greenlit. When are they going to do it? You know, it's like, when are they going to produce it? Because, you know, right now, like, who's going to walk into a set and risk their health, you know? And they were saying, well, there's sort of a reimagining of the TV sector now, where they're thinking about very few people will be on set. It'll be very, very closed, you know, and very tight-lipped. And so that sounds like a downsizing. That's only for high-end shows.
Right, but that's corporate America's dream. Great, right. We found a way to get rid of all these union people that we have to pay a lot of money to.
Right.
Now we just can't have you around. It's a health hazard to have 100 musicians or 30 right. musicians or 50 crew guys. We can't have you anymore.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So they dropped down to the indie guerrilla model to do everything.
Yes, exactly. That's where we're going to have to do. You know, and someone was saying recently too, like, you know, even with actors, you know, who, you know, normally work in collaborative spaces, with, you know, COVID-19, it's like, well, perhaps now you need to have CGI actors, because, you know, it's like, which then sort of starts downsizing real life people, you know, real life actors.
Yeah. That was part of Lionsgate's plan, was CGI actors. And what I wasn't clear about was, does that mean they want to use deep fake and pay you for the right to use your image, which of course they're going to do with superstars, or does that mean they're going to do this thing that you can do on AI now, which a lot of my ad friends do, where they just, this is their job. They take pictures of people who you associate with on your social media, and then they make a composite human being right. and add their pitch to you. So do they mean CGI actors, like composite human beings that don't exist?
I think so. I think what you just described, I think, is probably where it's going, because I think recently there was a CGI actor that just signed with CAA.
Oh, Limaquilla.
Yeah, right.
Oh my God.
Right. That's very telling.
Oh my God.
It's very telling. And I mean, you know, thinking about it as a in a business sense, even though it's hard to think about it that way, but in a business sense, it kind of makes sense if indeed COVID-19 sort of extends longer than, you know, anticipated, if there's another wave or two or three, and actors and whoever else is sort of like, I'm not going into any kind of collaborative space to shoot anything with anybody, then you are going to need content, because clearly content is still being encouraged. Like I said, I'm still having meetings where, as if nothing, I've had more meetings and more pitches during this stay-at-home order during the pandemic than I've had prior to it.
Mm.
I'm constantly busy. I'm like, I can't even just sort of sit back and kind of just figure out what's going on in the world, because I'm pitching and talking about television shows.
Wow, that's so cool. Awesome.
Yeah, so they definitely are stockpiling content. And yeah, like, you know, worst case scenario is, you know, this is extended for a longer time period. And so you're going to have somebody, some kind of images to sort of put in the content. So there you got CGI folk.
Do you know Neal Stephenson's work?
The name sounds really familiar.
He's a science fiction speculative fiction writer, and, he wrote a book in 1995. I think he wrote Zodiac. That's one of his novels,
yes.
Snow Crash. And he wrote a book, The Diamond Age, Young Ladies Illustrated Primer, in 95, which was predicting nanotechnology and Dynabooks and robotics. And as early as 95, there were things in his book called Ractors, which was, if you were an actor, you just... were like the audio narration of an avatar, and people could buy content and choose what raptors they wanted to animate the content that they wanted to see.
Exactly. I'm telling you, that's exactly it. So actors will be working with their voices.
Oof.
You know,
yeah.
It's interesting, you know, even like I was thinking about, Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower. And
just was reading that, yeah.
Right, and you know, that was also written in, I think, 1992, if I'm not mistaken, 1993. And she also sort of predicted what's happening right now. I think Parable takes place in 2025.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's one single it's one singular government. And you know, if you're sort of lucky enough to, I don't think it's about luck. I think you have a certain income bracket and or privilege. You were able to sort of be protected by the government and live in government housing that keeps you, you know, away from the sort of wild west that the world has become, at least this country has become. It's like post-virus. Like the novel takes place, it's like a post-virus and it's post, you know, government and economic collapse and, you know, people of color are living in abandoned gated communities once occupied by white people, you know, and then there's like these people who are addicted to this drug called pyro that makes them want to set things on fire. And you know, there's people who are starving because of the economic collapse, and they sort of move in this very slow kind of rhythm, much like zombies. And they can sense when you've eaten, so they kind of start walking toward you, but they can't get to you fast enough because they're going so slow. You know, it's just so crazy, right? And just the other, and there's all these feral dogs who are just like loose and running in packs and sort of attacking you because they're hungry too, right? And recently in California, I mean, at least in LA, there's been an increase in coyote sightings, like deeper into the city. Like even I live in the Crenshaw, sort of Baldwin Hills area, and there's been so many coyote sightings. There was one in my backyard earlier last week.
Wow. I don't know if you've seen Vina Sood's piece on Quibi. She's got this piece called The Stranger that's 5 minutes segments, and coyotes play a very big part in that in LA.
Wow. That's interesting. I'm going to check that out.
Oh, it's kind of amazing. It's kind of amazing how she was saying that when she met with Katzenberg about being on the thing, she had no interest. But the way he pitched it to her with the telephone as the great equalizer, because no matter how poor people are in the poorest African nations, everybody has a telephone. and this idea that you could have content on a telephone. And so she made this very meta show about the technology and what the technology, you know, kind of in a Black Mirror kind of world. It could have been a Black Mirror episode,
right.
But she's done it in the 5-minute Quibi model.
Wow. And what's it called again? Stranger?
It's called The Stranger, and it's on Quibi.
Quibi, okay.
Great. And it also got me thinking about Fall, which is another Neal Stephenson book, which is, I feel like we're there too, that in Fall, it's about a man who has put in his will that when he dies, he wants his consciousness uploaded to the cloud. But the world that you find yourself in before that happens is a world where people no longer agree on what is a fact. And so if you want to travel on land, you have to obey the rules and laws of each community as you travel through it. Like there's a community that burns crosses, but it means something different than what the Ku Klux Klan meant when they burned crosses.
Wow.
And there's this sense that people just are joining together around whatever they mutually believe and agree upon. And there's so much disinformation right now. Right. I had a kind of breakdown last week around what is real. You know,
yes.
45, because I don't speak that brand name,
please don't.
Is putting out that this virus is, you know, overinflated and not real. He's pushing that out already.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's I can't even, I think, I had a breakdown too, probably like a month ago when I was watching the news. I decided one day just to watch the news all day because I just said, let me just really try to understand what's happening. And I was just like, there is this person, this 45 is just lying out of the back of his head. Like just, and then the question is, why? Why would you want to lie? Like, why is this, like, are you that inept? Are you that evil?
I don't think that. I don't think he's inept. I think it is strategy. I mean, he says Mein Kampf, you know, he reads that's on his bedside. And was it Goebbels who said, and it became Hitler's mission, you know, a lie told once is a lie, but a lie told 1,000 times becomes a truth. I think this is pure strategy. And, you know, traditionally, when a country's in trouble, they don't want to switch leadership.
Right.
So the longer this trouble goes on,
yes.
as much as, you know, the press wants to tell you there'll be a change, people don't want to change ships in the middle of trouble.
Right. Exactly. I was just saying that to someone, when the Georgia governor decided to open up Georgia, and some of the sort of first things that he was opening were like, you know, hair salons and tattoo parlors and, you know, barbershops. And I thought to myself, and movie theaters or whatever. And I thought to myself, like, how are those things essential? How are those priorities? It sounds to me like you're just trying to put people back into the world so they can then be exposed, so then more people can be sick, and so then you can then shut it down again in a much more national way and then say, oh, you know something, we got to have the same president because we ain't got time to be worried about nothing. You can't even go out and vote. I mean, it just seems so reckless in a way that's like just not believable. It doesn't make any sense. It's not even logical.
Well, but I'm, you know, a total conspiracy theorist and I like to play devil's advocate. And if you think that in terms of the voting population, African Americans, we are the largest consistent voting bloc. And even if we've been down in the last few years, we are the largest consistent voting bloc. Whereas Caucasian Americans are the smallest voting bloc. They're the largest population, but they don't consistently vote for the size of their population. So, you know, it is dependent on us. We keep saving democracy in America, and now we're in the midst of a virus that is taking us out at a higher level.
Right.
So reopening organizations that are going to impact our health has a direct effect on election outcomes.
Yep, definitely. That's definitely an angle to look at it. Yes, agreed. Scary, very scary. I was talking to Katori Hall a couple of days ago because it was her birthday and then it was Mother's Day. So I just said, let me just reach out to her and give her a double hug. And And she was like, it's crazy out here, right? And I was like, it is crazy. And I said, we may have to go underground. And she was like, no, we cannot go underground. I was like, we may have to do something. Because we are just the most vulnerable community and have historically been vulnerable. Like, they always find a way to, like, stick their hand in and sort of shake us up, you know? It's always, it's just, yeah, it's crazy.
Hi, this is Tanya Pinkins. That was part one of my conversation with playwright, television writer, Keith Joseph Atkins. Please come back for part two of You Can't Say That on the Broadway Podcast Network.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.